Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Maggs with 30 minutes on South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. Interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers, leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Friday, the 28th of June. Coming up on the programme, there is growing concern over cabinet announcement silence, but a joint sitting of Parliament has been called. I'm going to try and make some sense of the national dialogue calls from civil society organisations. Johannesburg's water crisis, is there any end to this? A cyber attack at the new national laboratory, are lives now at risk? And a new radioisotope project to track rhinos. Now, government of national unity in jeopardy again, it seems, as the ANC and the DA at this point are unable to reach any sort of agreement on cabinet posts. A clash, we understand, over the important trade and industry ministry seems to be at the heart of this. But as we go to air, I'm also looking at something on social media from the ANC Secretary General Fikile Mbalula, who says almost done with GNU discussions in the best interests of all South Africans. It will be done as promised. At the same time, there is also talk around the creation of a broad church South African party in the future that would incorporate all members of the Government of National Unity. So let's try and pull all of this together. I want to test that idea in particular as well with Jaki Seliers from the Institute for Security Studies. Jaki, it's always good to talk to you, and thanks for talking to us. So on again, off again, we get moments of positive expectation, and then it seems things are back where they started. This current impasse, then, how are you reading it?
Good day, and thanks for inviting me. I think it's almost it's literally inevitable. These negotiations were never going to be easy. We all said to one another, it's going to be difficult. Parties are going to threaten to walk out. But eventually, I think only once you come to a kind of a hurting stalemate do you find that the grown men in the room realize what is at stake, and a lot is at stake for South Africa. And eventually, direct discussions, I think, between Steenhuisen and Ramaphosa will pull us through. So I'm quite positive and hopeful. And the X, whatever one calls it, from the ANC Secretary General, I think hopefully confirms that we will, within the next day or three, see the announcement of a cabinet, and that all South Africans can then get together by looking towards inclusive growth and unlocking the potential of the South African economy.
Jaki, if we look at ministerial positions, and let's rewind a little earlier in the week if we can, do you think the DA was misreading the room when it came to the extra ask as far as ministerial allocation was concerned, and particularly trade and industry? And again, there was also talk about the party creating what was termed a government within a government.
I think the talk about a government within a government, that's just trying to up the ante. You can't do that. The ANC is part, or the ANC and the DA are part of a cabinet. Cabinet decisions are taken by consensus. But I think that the mode of engagement was a problem. The writing of letters to one another, formal letters, you and I know when we write an email to one another how the other party often misinterprets the email. I think what was needed, and I think this was a very important letter, as Ramaphosa indicates, is for the parties to get together, literally lock the room, lock the door, and sort this out. So that with regard to the second part of your question, I think that we will have to see what the final composition is like. At the moment, it seems like the DA has lost out on most of the important economic opportunities. Of course, I think there's general, the Minister of Finance, I think people are generally happy with him, but I think that trade and industry, it's critical. And I think that, the DA wanted that. Doesn't look like they're going to get that. I don't think it's a deal breaker. We have a situation where the ANC has lost 17 percentage points in support. If they had a choice, they don't want to get in bed with the DA, and the reverse is also true. These parties come from hugely different ideological and all kinds of issues. So it's a big step forward for South Africa, but it's a first step in a journey, and that journey is going to take South Africa forward, I hope, because the alternative is literally too ghastly to contemplate, which would be where the ANC gets into bed with MK and EFF, parties that have do not believe in the constitution and really want to take us in an economic direction that would cause huge distress to South Africa. So I'm quite positive that things are moving in the right direction. It's going to be difficult.
Let's talk about that journey, and I guess it's fair to say that we're not even in first gear as far as the voyage is concerned. But down the line, once things do lock into place, whichever way it goes, this whole idea of a South African party is being touted, where all members of the GNU come together. It would mean a complete realignment of politics in South Africa. Is anything like that feasible, or are we getting ahead of ourselves?
Jeremy, no. So the where I made that call originally, it's about a vision for where we want to go in South Africa, and it's based on some hard political realities. And those hard political realities is that the DA is captured increasingly as a regional party, and the ANC is increasingly captured or condemned as a rural black party. Nobody has been able to mobilize the urban black vote. In actual fact, what has happened is that the ANC has split, and every time it has split, and if you add those splits up from MK, UDM, EFF, and so on, you get to where the ANC support was 30 years ago. So what we need to do in South Africa, given difficult as that is we need to build a coalition, a centrist coalition, that can bring these different racial groups' interests together to forge a new future. Because our constitution, our proportional representation system means that we are headed for a continued fragmentation. And the argument that I was making is that if you really have South Africa's interests at heart, then let's start working towards a centrist party that over time can emerge and that can take these different interests together in for the good of the country. Because the fragmented situation that we now have and that we will have for the next few years, and the divisions, the racial and other divisions, the historical animosities, they're not going to go away. We need to find a way of transcending that. That is not an amalgamation of the ANC and the DA. It is, in my view, a move towards a building a new centrist party eventually. It probably will start with a series of alliances that hopefully can take the country forward. But I do long-term forecasting, and one of the most important things is to have a clear understanding of where you come from and where you want to go. And that's very difficult in South Africa, given our past of apartheid and all of that kind of stuff. How do we build that? We have to start building that literally, in a sense, from the top downwards. Because remember what I started off with saying, ANC is increasingly a rural black nationalist party, the way it was going until recently. The DA is an urban white business-orientated party. And these two interests, we have to marry them if we are going to find a vision for South Africa, a vision that I refer to as a South Africa party. And that party must be built around what is our Bill of Rights and what's in our Constitution. And we will have to eventually paper over some of our history and some of the things that have happened. Because if you don't move collectively into the future, you are going to struggle. And right. Our current divisions are a problem for the country.
And that certainly is food for thought from the Institute for Security Studies. Jaki Cilliers, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, several civil society groups have joined forces to establish what is termed a national dialogue aimed at restoring what they term the legitimacy, credibility and enhancement of the South African Democratic Project. Nkosinathi Biko from the Steve Biko Foundation joins us on the program now. And firstly then, what is driving this particular initiative?
So the call for a national dialogue is motivated by the sense of despair that has come about because of the decline. And it's not just because of these elections, but for the past 10, 15 years, we have seen a steady degradation of our democracy and our body politic. And I think that because we've had election, and particularly because we are now trying to settle in a terrain we have never been in before of GNU or coalitions, it's an important time to re-engage citizens and get them involved in the development of a common vision that can get us onto a better traction and trajectory than we have been. And this is not new, Jeremy. I think we've done this in the past at various stages in our society, where society raises its voice to determine and direct better how they want to be governed.
You talk about a degradation of democracy in South Africa. That's a big criticism. What are your specific concerns?
Well, there are a number of areas that we point to. The first is in the sphere of governance. We, just judging, for instance, by the number of issues that have played out in the courts in South Africa, there are massive issues around leadership. And it's of concern and should be of concern to South Africans. We point to the economy of this country as an area that is of concern to us, an economy that has rejected the majority of its citizens in that they live beneath the breadline. I think the figure is about 54%, and unemployment statistics being at about 32 or thereabout. And that is of concern to us. And these are things that have gone off track, if you will. We set out to build a united, egalitarian, democratic South Africa. And I think that there is evidence that we are far from that ideal. This being the occasion of the 30th anniversary of our democracy is about as good as time as any to think about what we want over the next 30 years.
I'm hearing a subtext here, and that is that you have little or no faith in a government of national unity to solve or at least engage with the problems that you're outlining.
You know, Jeremy, from the perspective of the Steve Biko Foundation, at least, one would have wished that this is the time, in fact, when politicians are able to translate the ultimate message of voters in the last election. So voters seem to have had little confidence in all of the parties. And so one would have wished to see a conversation now that says we are trying to form a government of national unity around these fundamental principles, right? We have had you as a public. But that is not what is happening. Now, as an observer, you would wish that some of these questions are probed by the opposition. But what is the opposition doing? It seems to be settling and seems to be throwing away some of the very promises it was making to the public. I mean, take the issue, for instance, of CADA deployment, which is really where these negotiations are stuck. It's around positions beyond the values. We don't know what are the common issues, or at least on the values, on the major issues, whether it's foreign policy, whether it's transformation of the economy, and so forth, that have been settled between these parties. We certainly know the number of seats that each want and so forth. And I'm not certain that that is something that should not leave us uneasy.
Are you not being a little preemptive? Should you not be giving the GNU some sort of time to settle before you start making the call for the national dialogue?
No. And the call for the national dialogue is not exclusive of government. We expect government to be at that table. Remember that the president himself has made a pronouncement on the issue of a national dialogue. that it's time to have a national dialogue. And he did so just as he was being installed as a president for this administration. The statement of intent by all of these parties referenced the need for a national dialogue. And so what the call is that we are making is to build infrastructure that is inclusive of citizens. So it's a bottom-up, if you like, call, where we are trying to mobilize citizens so that it is not government sitting in a supposed national government talking about us as citizens, but we are right there. And in being there, what we are trying to encourage people to do is to interpret the meaning of the X that they placed on the 29th of May and hopefully recalibrate our society.
I am going to leave it there. Nkosinathi Biko from the Steve Biko Foundation, thank you very much for talking to me today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
I don't need to tell you that scores of Johannesburg suburbs remain without water this Friday due to ongoing maintenance at Rand Water's pump stations. Despite scheduled maintenance plans, these appear to be running behind schedule and water is not being pumped at specific rates as has been promised, it seems. Johannesburg Councillor Nicole van Dyk has her finger on the pulse of this issue and joins me now on the program. And what then are you hearing about these delays?
So we are not hearing much at this point. As I speak to you at the moment, we've been informed by Joburg Water that most of the reservoirs and systems across Joburg North, which would include Roodepoort, Randburg, are completely dry. It also encompasses large parts of the south and the east of Johannesburg. It's not clear when Rand Water started pumping at 83%. Some of the statements said that they started doing it last night. There's been some information that they only started doing it this morning. So we are not clear on where Rand Water is in terms of their recovery period in order to start pumping through to Johannesburg Water.
And when you reach out to Rand Water, which I assume that you or your colleagues have done, what are they telling you?
Well, it's very hard to reach seniors at Rand Water. Often Rand Water will tell you that councillors and residents are not their customer. Joburg Water is. So Joburg Water needs to communicate. Essentially, what a lot of councillors tend on doing is trying to get to the reservoirs, hoping to find some management there and get answers. When we do this in the last 2 days, though, Rand Water has said we are not going to talk to you. So we are not getting answers from Rand Water.
This is a large swathe of Greater Johannesburg. Do you have any sense of potentially how many people are impacted?
I mean, at this stage, if you calculate it, it's about 20 wards that are affected, and each ward is around 30 to 40,000 residents. So a few times that, that will give you your outcome figure. Yeah.
Do you have a sense of why this needed to be done, this maintenance, in one fell swoop? One's got to ask questions about how this whole process, and I guess the idea of maintenance is important and should be welcomed, but why all at once?
Absolutely. Well, that's a great question. I mean, Rand Water said that they were doing it because generally water usage in the winter period is not very high. So they took advantage of this winter period. We've been told it's also got some kind of connection to the Lesotho Highlands project that's coming. So this is to help increase capacity into the metros. However, I think the biggest frustration, and this has to be said, a lot of the time building up to this maintenance, we were told that we weren't going to be seeing dry taps, just a reduction of flow. And now that seems to be completely turned on its head. So the question of why all this maintenance had to be done immediately within a five-week period is a question that I sadly don't have the answer to, and one I would definitely ask of Rand Water.
What are your residents, your constituents, telling you today?
They are absolutely furious. It's absolutely with what I said. A lot of residents anticipated the reduced flow. Many weren't expecting dry taps, and particularly in the Randburg area, which consists of four wards that are fed from the Linden system. They've been struggling with water for the last couple of weeks because of the massive bursts that are occurring at Corner Judges and Republic in the Cresta area. So they have, for the last 4 weeks, already had very little to no supply. So their frustration is growing immensely, and this was the group that was hit very hard in March when they went 14, 15 days with no water. So these residents aren't accepting it. They don't want to hear about water tankers. They don't want to hear about plans. They just want to know when their water is going to come on. And no one is willing to give that information up to the councillors.
So let's talk about water tankers then. We do see indication of tankers being sent to places within Greater Johannesburg. Is this alleviating the problem in any way?
I mean, in a very minor way. Joburg Water has 85 tankers for the whole city. They've also recruited 251 stationary tanks. Despite multiple requests by councillors yesterday right across the city, a lot of us struggled to get tankers. Myself personally, I asked four times for tankers yesterday, and I only got my first and only tanker last night at 8:30. A lot of residents aren't going to go out at that time. You know, they're looking after their kids. Their kids are already in bed. It's cold. They're not going to go out at that point in time. So despite having 85 tankers, the movement of the tankers, the scheduling of the tankers, which is a constant problem, every single any time there's an issue with Joburg Water, between their comms and the tanker allocations, this is always the biggest fight. And despite, and I'm not quite sure how it is that they managed to get a significant number of more tankers, and yet we are still struggling to get any kind of tankers into our areas.
I am going to leave it there. Councillor Nicole van Dyk, thank you very much indeed for that assessment.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
The Daily Maverick reporting this week that senior doctors working in the public health system are calling for urgent intervention to speed up medical testing after the National Health Laboratory Service had to shut down its communication system because of a cyber attack. The chief executive officer of the service is Professor Koleka Mlisana and joins us on the program now. Professor, welcome and thank you very much indeed. First of all, how did this happen and have things been resolved?
Hi, thanks. Thank you very much, Jeremy, and good day or good afternoon to your listeners. So we discovered this early hours of Saturday morning, wherein our users could not access our systems, particularly the lab information system, which every lab uses. And then when IT was called in, they had to look through, and they had to also get more suppliers, users who support us. And then they discovered that there was a ransomware virus that had infiltrated our operations. Now, the area when they explored that they realized was affected is at applications interface. So we have the LIS, which is the laboratory information system that's got patients' information, which is sitting on a different platform. We have the Oracle system that looks at salaries and, you know, HR and financial applications, which sits on a different platform as well, that database. But then for us to operate the LIS, it's got to go through the application system, which is why then we could not have access to that, because that's where the virus had infiltrated. We also have got our documents management in that that application system, including Microsoft and a few other applications. So we therefore could not have access, which meant then the labs had to go on to operating manually. Can't register or, you know, onto the system, register the work that's coming in, nor be able to print results. That's where the challenge has been.
So, Professor, do you think that the service was deliberately targeted, or was this just pure software or software malfunction as far as you're concerned?
No. There definitely was a ransomware virus that infiltrated us. And in fact, they were able to further identify that there was a message that came in identifying themselves as Black Suit, and which therefore meant there was a definite cyber attack.
So what are you going to do to prevent this from happening in the future?
Well, there's a lot that we're going to have to do. Obviously, it means now we need to clean up our environment and build a new environment, because the cyber security specialists are advising us how such, you know, attacks work and how we therefore need to start to rebuild to the level that we need to get to. But there's a lot of additional, you know, security levels and whether, you know, we should be on cloud, which might be safer. So, I mean, we are already implementing those proposals that are coming. We've got a huge team that's on site, ensuring that we can build. And also, even our backup data was interfered with. Fortunately, we had a third backup. So they are currently reading the tapes that we're using as backup.
Professor, so I just want to ask you very briefly about consequence, if I can. Given the critical need for timely test results, I'm assuming that contingency plans are in place to mitigate the risk of delay, which would have impact or it would affect patient outcome.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. In fact, I've just came out of a meeting there with the team. We are getting a lot of support because, remember, we've got different instruments on our platforms, and the various suppliers are coming up with suggestions where we are able to take some of their, like, there's something that they call middleware, which we can remove out of our infected environment and then link that to their instruments. Then we're able to register results and print reports thereafter. So there are various mitigating mechanisms we are exploring. We are also looking at an overall system, electronic system, that we can use. And our IT system just gave us feedback now that they can be able to give us the first, you know, the 10 common, you know, high volume tests. They could be on that system by Monday. So we are exploring how we can move over this a difficult time.
All right. Indeed. Thank you very much indeed, Professor Koleka Mlisana from the National Health Laboratory Service. She is the Chief Executive Officer.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
In conclusion, something called the RISOTOPE project at Wits University is entering a new testing phase with the insertion of radioisotopes into 20 live rhinoceros. After 3 years of meticulous and dedicated work, the project at the university has now successfully inserted low doses of radioisotopes into these animals. More now from Jessica Babick, who is Chief Operating Officer of the project. And firstly, Jessica, what is the aim then of this project?
The project was born out of a need to try and tackle the rhino poaching crisis. And when Professor James Larkin, who's the director of the Health, Physics and Radiation Unit at Wits University, approached me a few years ago with the concept of using nuclear technology to perhaps try and protect these animals, it was a very intriguing concept. And so a lot of work has taken place over the last few years, massive amounts of research, which has brought us to the point where we are today and on the back of being able to treat 20 live animals during the course of this past week.
So when you talk about treating them, what does that actually mean?
What it means is that with James's science and with phenomenal backing from the nuclear world, I must tell you, the International Energy Atomic Agency has been instrumental in supporting us, as has NECSA, our own Nuclear Energy Corporation of South Africa, and of course, Wits University itself, because there's been a lot of research that's been conducted. So what I mean when I say treating the animals, it's that the nuclear technology has now been refined to enable us to place small measured quantities of radioisotopes into the horns of rhinos. And that is what took place this week.
And at the end of this project, and I understand that there is going to be a six-month observation period, what are you hoping to achieve?
Well, it's actually very exciting. Back in 2001, we treated two white rhino bulls at Buffalo Kloof Game Reserve in the Eastern Cape with stable compounds. That was also a six-month fieldwork exercise where we could take blood samples and fecal analysis to show that there was no movement of this stable compound through the horn and into the body or soft tissue of the animal. What has happened now is that Professor Larkin has measured the dosages to perfection, enabling us to put actual radioisotopes into the horns of these 20 animals. And the same procedure will follow, where they are monitored very closely over these 6 months. At the end of that period, we shall again take blood samples and all the other necessary samples to send through to the laboratories so that we can conclusively prove with all proper analytical governance protocols and scientific endeavors to prove that there's no movement of the isotopic elements into the body of the animal in any way. Zero harm to the animal. That's our goal.
And in what respect then is this going to alleviate, or at least try to alleviate, the rhino poaching problem?
Oh, that's such a great question. I just want to say, first of all, that any and all entities and people that are rhino owners or protectors of rhinos are doing a phenomenal job. It's a really hard job. And unfortunately, what's happened with the poaching scourge is that we found that it's now leading to a disinvestment of the species. We need rhinos in our ecosystems as mega herbivores. They allow a cascade of life to flourish beneath them. They are really important. And, if we end up losing mega herbivores, that's going to have tremendously negative ecological impact. So that's the one thing. But what has not been able to be done before is, in the event that a horn is poached, that means that the poachers have gotten through multiple defense mechanisms that the various reserves or entities have put up. That's from the extraordinarily brave ranger services and foot patrols that they have on the ground, all the way through to other integrated tech, which comes in all sorts of ways, shapes, and forms. There's actually some great, exciting technological developments in the conservation world. But one of the greatest challenges is that once a horn is poached and once it departs on its journey across to the end user markets, it's very difficult to track and trace. And so by inserting these radioisotopes, we are now able to activate a global nuclear security architecture. There are over 11,000 radiation detection portals at ports of entry around the world. That's airports and harbors, etc. And that means that our detection capabilities are amplified thousands of times over. This is in addition to the radiation personnel that work on the ground with handheld detectors. So now we've amplified our ground force exponentially. In addition to that, the sentencing that's applied to anybody caught with any radioactive materials is much, much harsher than the sentencing that currently applies in the event that smugglers get caught with any contraband items. In addition to that, we are hoping to deter the end user markets, because everyone has a natural aversion to nuclear or radioactive substances. And so we are hoping that this will also quell the desire for the product in the end user markets.
The entire project, of course, is predicated on the fact that there will be good follow-up action once identification has been made in terms of transgression.
Yes, and this is where it's very exciting. I mean, I'm only giving you some of the surface information now, but I can tell you that this is a truly international collaboration with other universities and institutes around the world that have partnered and collaborated with us. In addition to the high-level nuclear security entities with regards to making sure that we are working closely with everybody so that the proper security observations and in the event that a horn gets poached that has been treated, then all the systems and the people are activated in the right way. So it's a huge, huge global effort. I've literally just skimmed the surface with you on that one, but effectively that's the way that it's going to work.
Jessica Babbage, thank you very much indeed for talking to me today. And before we go, our last online poll, we spoke about SA ID cards. I asked if you still had a green book, an ID card, or if you were worried about the switch. And most people responding to our poll still operating with the green ID book. Today, talk of a single coalition political party could work. Not a chance. Or let's get a cabinet first. If you'd like to participate in that poll, I'll have the results on Monday. Please go to either our X or LinkedIn pages. That's our program for today. MoneyWeb at midday. We are live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.